Who wants to end the Russia-Ukraine war and who doesn't? Now, you may think, and in fact, if you've been listening to Western media, you believe that it's definitely those darn Russians that don't want to end the war, and the Europeans only want a just and lasting peace and are willing to do whatever it takes to get it done. Or so that's what the narrative is. But when you look at the actual actions, and especially in light now that the United States has authored a potential 28-point peace plan that they're pushing pretty hard on both Ukraine and on Russia, then we have to look and say, who is actually supportive of this and who is against it? And that will tell you with actions a lot more than words do. And to try and help make some sense out of what we're hearing from multiple quarters today, we have back with us the amazing Jacques Beau, colonel and former member of the Swiss Intelligence Service and former NATO officer and friend of the show. Colonel, as always, delighted to have you here.
As always, thank you very much for inviting me. Happy to be with the show again.
Well, listen, let's just jump right into it. This whole 28-point peace plan, we've had a lot of information coming out that the United States has said, hey, it's time to get this done here. And apparently, and if you're kind of reading between the lines, what the conversation between Trump and Putin last August in Anchorage, Alaska, seems to have based the formation of this plan here. And we're not sure why it's taken this long to get it out, but both sides seem to keep referring back to that meeting. What do you make, first of all, just of this announcement that there's been this 28-point peace plan on the table?
Well, it was kind of a surprise because we knew that you had this discussion in Anchorage between Putin and Trump, that something was decided there. But Donald Trump failed to come back to the Russians with a kind of approval from the Europeans and from Ukraine. And that, in fact, is the reason why the summit in Budapest was postponed. And all this story was told by Sergei Lavrov in various interviews he had with Kommersant and with the Corriere della Sera, this Italian journal. So We didn't know exactly what was the details of the discussion, and probably what we have here is largely based on the discussion, because what we can see, I mean, the elements I have, I don't know exactly all the details. I haven't seen all the 28 points, but one aspect that confirms what we have heard from Sergei Lavrov, as an example, is the fact that in this 28-point plan, it is planned to have the whole Donbass, that means the oblasts of Donetsk and Lugansk, completely to give them completely to Russia, while the two others, that means Kherson and Zaporozhye, unlike what Vladimir Putin asked for as a condition in June 2024, these oblasts will not be in totality recognized as Russian. They will be recognized up to the front line, the combat line, meaning that it is kind of a compromise between the Kellogg plan that asked for a delineation on the combat line and the requirement of Vladimir Putin that asked for a delineation on the political border of those oblasts. So for the Donetsk, it works. These are the political borders, while on the two others, it's the combat front line that makes the delineation. So this is kind of a compromise. But there are other aspects that I can understand may trigger the opposition of the Europeans and of Ukraine. This is the fact that these territories are recognized as Russian, first of all. I mean, the Donbass and part of the oblast of Kherson and Zaporozhye, and that Ukraine will be de jure, that means legally, considered as part of the Russian Federation, which is in contradiction to what we have heard so far from the in the West, that nobody wanted to recognize the annexation of the peninsula that happened in 2014. Now, so these are the few elements. There are some others. I think the another point, for instance, is that the request for the NATO membership would be abandoned. But that is not really a surprise, because in fact we have heard from the State Department, both Biden and Trump's State Department, I mean Blinken and Rubio now. We have heard that from Biden at that time, but also by from Donald Trump, that there was no question. I mean, the Ukraine would not be member of NATO. And you may remember, I have mentioned that many times, but as early as March 2022, Zelensky himself, in an interview to CNN, said that when he asked Biden whether or not Ukraine would be member of NATO, Biden responded that no, he would not be member of NATO. But in for the open public, publicly, they will say that the door is open.
So right. Actually, more than just the door is open. At the Washington summit of the NATO under Biden's last term in office, they outright said it's inevitable. They are going to come in.
Well,
one has to wonder what is the value, what is the intent of saying one thing behind the scenes that is self-evident, everybody knows it's true, and then keep saying this other one out in the public. Why the contradictory messages that you know aren't ever going to be resolved?
Well, that's exactly the problem. I mean, we have here a narrative that, in fact, was more or less designed to tackle the Russians, because everybody knew it was not possible. By the way, on the several NATO summits that happened, well, they confirmed that Ukraine would be member of NATO. They never outlined a membership action plan. The map, the so-called right. map, that is normally when a country. First of all, the process is that some country may have an interest to be part of NATO, but it's not the acceptance of the membership is not based on the request. It's a decision of the NATO Council when they decide, and the criteria is that the membership should be in favor of the geostrategic balance. I mean, it should not be a geopolitical problem, basically. It should not affect the security of the continent. That's a criteria. And with Ukraine, obviously, if Ukraine would be member of NATO, this would affect the security of the continent. And
yeah,
for that reason,
I'll point out.
That's an essential point. That's, I think, Article 10 of the NATO Charter. I may be wrong, but I think it's that.
So let me ask you, I mean, you've got some history. You served for a period of time as a NATO officer. You've been observing this probably for most of your adult life. There seems to have been a shift to me that from a real politic where we used to at least come close to telling the truth, or at least saying things out loud that were relatively obviously true also behind the scenes, to the point that we're now, it's just night and day difference. It's just almost light and dark about what we believe in private and what we say in public. Why do you suppose it is, and how have you seen that transition?
Well, the thing is that I think, first of all, in 2008, as the membership of Ukraine was mentioned, probably the American didn't understand exactly what would be the implication on the relations with Russia. Or better said, they underestimated the impact of that.
And why do you suppose it is? I mean, let's just hit on that, because that's during the George Bush period of time. And I believe it was then Ambassador Burns that said, there's no way Russia will not allow this. Nyet means nyet, I think, is the famous thing that he said. So
yeah.
We had some knowledge inside.
Absolutely.
And Bush allegedly, had a good relationship with Putin. So how do you suppose we missed that one?
Well, but remember, that was the time where George Bush and all this, his predecessor, by the way, they had this kind of this mentality of the Wolfowitz doctrine. I mean, that the U.S. should be the leading country in the world, and they decide. It's up to the U.S., not to the others to decide. It's more or less this kind of mood, you know? And therefore, they would not be intimidated by some negative reaction from Russia, especially that in 2008, Russia was still kind of had a weak economy. It was recovering from the Yeltsin years. It was still in a build-up phase, but it was not, it didn't achieve what it has done so since then. So meaning that Russia was not considered as the superpower it used to be during the Cold War. Therefore, there was no real challenge in saying, well, the U.S. decides or the West decides, and Russia must simply obey. That was a little bit the idea.
What a catastrophic decision that really was, because that's set in motion a lot of the things that are playing out right now. And let's get back to this 28-point peace plan. The Wall Street Journal is reporting an interesting fact here. Gary, if you could put that full screen up. One thing that's important here, I'm going to tell you why just in a second. The Trump administration has drafted, the Trump administration, not Russia, not Ukraine, not Europe. The Trump administration has drafted this peace plan that calls for Ukraine to make major territorial concessions to Russia and drop demands for peacekeeping force to deter future attacks by Moscow. But the blueprint, which was worked out by Rubio, Witkoff, and Jared Kushner in consultation with the Kremlin confidant Kirill Dmitriev, is likely to run into strong opposition in Kiev and from European governments. As it turns out, it's a lot stronger, and it came really quickly. Here was, I believe it was earlier today, Kaya Kallas just flat out rejects this proposal.
In order to end this war, you need the Ukrainians and the Europeans also to agree to those plans. So, of course, Putin could end this war immediately if he just stopped bombing civilians and killing the people. But we haven't seen any concessions on the Russian side. We welcome all the meaningful efforts to end this war. But like we have said before, it has to be just and lasting. That also means that Ukrainians, but also Europeans, agreed to this.
And, you know, and right before she made her comments there, the question from the reporter was about this 28-point peace plan, and do you agree with it? And she just flat out said no, and then went on into talking about that other stuff there. And I thought, wow, that was a pretty strong and direct repudiation. But then it's like, there's also a repudiation from logic and common sense. And like your view on this, I mean, we'll just start off with here is that she seems like beside herself for three things, as I see it. The first one is that how dare Europe and Ukraine not be consulted with this? We'll talk about that one. But then the second one here is she has the audacity to say how there's no concessions from Russia in here. What do you make of that?
Well, first of all, to the first point, Europe has made itself irrelevant in this whole story. I mean, since the very beginning of the conflict, and I could say even since 2014, the European diplomacy has contributed to nothing to the solution of the conflict. You had, I mean, obviously not during the Biden era, but as soon as the Trump administration came, you had some efforts. I'm not sure they were always with the right strategy and all that, but nevertheless, there was an effort by the Trump administration to find a solution somehow to the problem. They tried with Keith Kellogg and all that. That was, let's say, a little bit clumsy, but at least it was a trial. Now, the thing is that if you look at Europe, by the way, they never tried even to help the U.S. in that. They even tried to stop the U.S. to solve the issue. So the problem of the European Union diplomacy is that it doesn't really exist. I mean, you have Kaya Kallas, And every time she opens her mouth, it's about Russia. It's Russia, Russia, Russia.
And about she confrontation, goes, confrontation, confrontation. Never this is about always that.
I mean, she goes to China to discuss. I mean, there are many issues that could be discussed between Europe and China, but no, the main topic is Russia. So it's kind of an obsession. And you can hear that from other leaders. I mean, Emmanuel Macron, Keir Starmer, Mr. Stubb from Finland, and all that. I mean, and not even mentioning the Baltic state. I mean, it's all about Russia, period. They don't even care what's happening in Ukraine, by the way. They just want to harm or to defeat Russia. They don't even know how. They don't even know by which mean they can defeat Russia, but they won't defeat Russia. So it's kind of a stupid, really, approach, because I don't find any more polite words to define this, because they never made any attempt to provide some diplomatic support to Ukraine, for instance.
Well, and in fact, she, in that same conversation there, she did offer what she claims was one thing that they tried to offer, and that was to offer Russia an unconditional ceasefire.
Of course, for any plan to work, it needs Ukrainians and Europeans on board. So this is very clear. Also, we have to understand that in this war, there is one aggressor and one victim. So we haven't heard of any concessions on the Russian side. I mean, if Russia really wanted peace, it could have, agreed to unconditional ceasefire already some time ago.
Yeah, so, I mean, that shows that Russia doesn't want peace because they didn't take our terms that would be beneficial to us and detrimental to them. So what's wrong with that?
Well, you may remember that the idea of an unconditional ceasefire was mentioned in the Oval Office by Friedrich Merz during this meeting with Zelensky. I think it was the 18th of August or so. And where you had all the European leaders and Ursula von der Leyen. And Friedrich Merz mentioned the unconditional ceasefire. And Donald Trump said no. No, because he thought, and that was just after the meeting he had with Putin in Anchorage, and I think Putin probably managed to convince him that if you want to have a sustainable solution for this conflict, you cannot go with an unconditional ceasefire first. You have to go through a peace process. And in that peace process, you may have a ceasefire, but first of all, you have to define the process. And in fact, that's exactly what the Russians have proposed in the memorandum they provided to the Ukrainian delegation in March this year in Istanbul. And that was a constant approach of the Russians. By the way, that's also what Vladimir Putin said in June 2024 when he said there are two preconditions for negotiation, that the withdrawal of all Ukrainian forces from the four oblasts that we mentioned before, and Ukraine should abandon its request to be member of NATO. Once Ukraine has done that, then we can enter immediately into a ceasefire and enter a peace negotiation process. So that's exactly what Putin said. And I think Donald Trump understood that, in fact, because the Russia is, in fact, leading on the ground, because this is is winning on the ground, then the only solution is to go through this process, which doesn't exclude any negotiation, which doesn't exclude any a ceasefire. But this ceasefire must not hang in the air. It must be a ceasefire that is bound to a peace process and that should lead to an agreement. And this agreement is signed by both parties. Remember that in March 2022, Zelensky proposed such measures, and in fact, a lot of measures that are in the various points I know from this 28-point plan. These were items that were already presented by Zelensky, like the neutrality of Ukraine, like the fact that Ukraine would have a reduced armed force, like the fact that there would be no foreign troops on Ukrainian territory. All that was already in the proposition that Zelensky proposed to the Russians in March 2022. So there's nothing really new. What is new, obviously, is the fact that in March 2022, the Russians accepted to withdraw all their forces from Ukraine. But today, things have changed. Zelensky has withdrawn his project on the request of the upon request of the Europeans. So the Russians have said, "Well, you withdrew your proposal, so now we continue the war. Now don't go back to what you just refused last time." And therefore, now we are where we are. The Russians are—they are winning. Of course, in March 2022, there was this narrative that the Russians were collecting microchips from wash machine for their missiles and all that, and that Russia was about to collapse, and therefore. And that's the reason why Zelensky, by the way, withdrew his proposal, because this was this prospect of a Russian defeat. The problem is that he gambled and he lost because Russia is winning. And that's a problem because the Europeans are also the culprit in that, because they pressed Zelensky to withdraw his proposal and to engage into further combat. The problem is that because in Europe at that time, everybody was convinced that Russia was about to collapse, they took the risk. The problem is that, as I wrote in my book at that time, at precisely that time, my first book, Operation Z, was written exactly at that time, and it was absolutely no indication whatsoever that Russia would be about to collapse. So it was a complete misinformation that was the basis of this narrative that eventually guided or misguided the policy of Europe. And
you know, Colonel, I got to say, one of the things that is so both anguishing and disheartening is that for all that miscalculation, and it's been self-evident over the years just how profound of a disaster those decisions were. And you would think that just in the normal course of events that people would go, holy cow, well, that didn't work out well. Let's don't do that again. And instead, here we are again. And I could probably point out five or six other things that happened in between now and that time. But where we are right now is that clearly Ukraine is going to lose this war. I mean, many people are saying it out loud now. But in light of this, you would rationally think this is a lifeline that could end the death and destruction under the least objectionable terms, because they can get a lot worse. But instead, you have Kaya Kallas sitting there mocking Russia for not doing something against their own interests that we have no power to compel upon them. And as she said, also, you know, you can't do this without Europe and Ukraine. And as it turns out, both Europe and Ukraine are again trying to repeat these disastrous decisions of the past, as exemplified by this member of the Ukrainian member of parliament.
We are ready for peace. Ukraine, from March of this year, agreed to freeze the conflict on the current lines. And the war continues only because Russia wants to continue the war and doesn't want peace. We here in Ukraine, we want peace. We will never accept surrender, because Russia can't achieve its goals by military way. Russia uses, again, hybrid attacks on the borders with Lithuania, Latvia, Poland, Estonia, all the time. So Russia is escalating hybrid war, and not just against Ukraine. The actual aim of Russia is the war against the whole Europe, and they are already testing the reaction and the capacities of European countries to answer on Russian provocations.
Now, you just got through illustrating how what a disastrous decision. It was known at the time that Russia had the wherewithal to weather the storm in 2022, and it would be foolish to think that they're not going to be able to win it. But now here you have it closing in on the four-year mark of this war. This guy actually saying Russia can't win militarily. What do you do with that?
Well, you know, there's a problem of irrationality of the decision-making in Europe at large. I mean, we can come back to all the decision regarding the economy, the energy supply, and all that. I mean, all that confirms more or less that you have kind of a, not even ideological, because there is no ideology per se, but let's say an emotional type of leadership that hates Putin for some reason, and all the calculation, all the decisions are based on this very base. When we talk about the hybrid warfare and all that, I mean, as this MP was mentioning, I mean, there have been some events and in the country where I live, in Belgium as well, but nobody has never made any demonstration or provided any evidence that everything we see is the result of some Russian activities. I mean, if you look at the drones, for instance, if you look just at what was happening in the US, the number of events involving drones around airport or sensitive object, you have about 600,000 occurrence in the US per year, 600,000. So in Europe, I assume you should have something very similar. You have statistics in the US. It's very interesting. But so that's why I mentioned the US and not Europe. But I assume that you should have something similar in Europe. I mean, a lot of people, because they don't know, or they are youngsters who play with their drones and things like this, then you have, and of course, around an airport, regardless of what the intent is, a drone in around an airport is a dangerous matter, and therefore it has to be sanctioned somehow. But the problem is that we have also these events every day in Europe, but now we focus just on those we cannot explain, or we didn't got the perpetrators, and we said these are the Russians. And in most cases, all the time they have arrested someone, it was not even a Russian, it was a Croat, a Germans, a Norwegian, Ukrainians even.
But yeah, they never come back and say, oh, by the way, it turned out that wasn't a Russian, it was a Croat. Yeah,
you don't exactly hear that. Exactly. So this is feeding kind of a narrative that you have an ongoing hybrid war waged by Russia. But think about it. What would be the objective of that? Would the Russians try to exacerbate the situation even more, to attract more sanctions, to attract more problems? I mean, this doesn't make any sense. And we can see when we make, let's say, a honest analysis of decision-making in Russia, we see that the decision-making is extremely rational. We may not like it, but it is extremely rational. And when they decide something, there's always a good explanation for that. So this idea of a wild hybrid warfare everywhere around Europe and all that, it doesn't make any sense. But that feeds the narrative. And that also feeds this narrative that because Russia is not achieving success on the ground, therefore, it has to go into hybrid warfare to tackle the Europeans and NATO and whoever. And recently, the foreign minister of France said, well, Russia is defeated in Ukraine because in the last three years, it managed to gain only 1% of Ukrainian territory. Again, we are in this kind of metrics where we measure the success in square kilometers. And if you look at the data. I mean, I look at the data provided by War Tears, which is an Ukrainian NGO that makes some calculation. Again, it's calculated, so we have to be very careful with those figures. But nevertheless, if we talk the number of casualties registered or computed by War Tears in the last 3 years, I mean, during the time Russia gained those 1% of the Ukraine territory, you have almost 600,000 Ukrainian who died. And remember,
you know, right now, I mean, not even on top of that, you also have the issue that in the last 2 months, especially, you've had an acceleration of territory gained by the Russians. According to Julian Rupka, it could be as much by the end of this month, depending on how things go, close to 900 to possibly 1,000 square kilometers this month alone, which would set an all-time record. So
I agree. Speed. I agree, but remember again, you define success when you compare the result to the stated objectives. And what was the objective? Was demilitarization. Demilitarization refers to a potential, not to territory. Meaning that, and that's very much Clausewitzian, and the book on the Russian art of war is explicit on that the Russian military doctrine is based on the destruction of a potential. As Clausewitz said, you have to destroy the potential, the military potential. It's not territory that is the key aspect. Therefore, if you compare now the 1% that has been gained, and probably, as you rightly said, you have an acceleration so far. But again, this is not the main point. The main point is that the Russians managed to destroy, in fact, they have destroyed twice or probably three times the initial Ukrainian army. So it's but of course, since nobody talks about Ukrainian casualties or even fatalities, then of course nobody can verify this. Me neither, by the way. I'm just based on this the figures provided by War Tears, and they may be wrong. But again, this is just to highlight the difference between this 1% of territory that is used in the Western narrative and the number of casualties and fatalities. In fact, when I talk about 600 people, I'm talking about fatalities for Ukraine. Fatalities, not casualties. Meaning
or desertions, for that matter, which by this year alone are 161,000, according to Ukrainian sources. You know, now then you're getting to the point to where you're getting both. Because if you do destroy, and just for those who may not know, the logic behind the Russian strategic objectives is if you destroy the capacity, you're going to get the territory in one big blow. You don't have to take it piece by piece. And they're doing it in the air. They're doing it with the infrastructure, and they're doing it with the personnel. And I mean, and the economy for that matter. So it's a really across the board, and it's really starting to have an effect. Now, that brings us back into this potential for a peace plan, because there are those who recognize everything you just said, and they're looking on the ground and thinking this can't end well. And we are Kaya Kallas aside, or the Zelensky aside, who may want to keep going. They won't be able to because the numbers are what they are. Now, I wish I could just keep the bony finger pointed at the Europeans and at the Ukrainians. Unfortunately, there are those right here in Washington, D.C. on Fox News who seem to be pushing the same bad narrative.
You'll have to excuse me, John, for not being optimistic at all. And I base that on the decades I spent at CIA trying to see the world through the twisted KGB eyes of Vladimir Putin. If past is prologue, he's trying to use negotiations to curry some favor with the United States, make it appear falsely that Russia's interested in a diplomatic solution to this war, when in fact Russia continues to rain down hell on Ukraine. Just last night, a massive drone and missile barrage in a residential area in Ukraine. The timing is important. We've got sanctions against Rosneft and Lukoil being implemented in about 3 days. And then the Senate has their secondary sanctions bill warmed up in the bullpen. The president said he's going to sign it. So that may also be something that Vladimir Putin is thinking about when he wants to try to run this KGB false operation, disinformation operation against us to make us think that he might be interested in negotiations.
I mean, first of all, what are you talking about, a false flag operation by the Russians? This is an American peace plan. As I put it on that headline at the very beginning here, it was formed by Secretary of State Witkoff and the president's son-in-law, exactly, Jared Kushner. So it's not a Russian misinformation. But I mean, he's still just basically, he probably could just be singing the same tune, second verse, with Kaya Kallas. How can we make sense of this?
Well, the problem is that, of course, first of all, the Europeans don't want to negotiate with Russia. That's the first point. They don't want it. And the position of the Russians is very clear. And in fact, as I had said before, I mentioned the two conditions that Putin defined in June last year. These are conditions to start the process of negotiating, meaning that the Russians are not against negotiation, but they have set conditions to start the process. And those two conditions I said is the withdrawal from Oblast and the abandonment of the NATO membership. These are the two conditions. And since the Europeans make every effort to prevent Zelensky to comply with those two conditions, well, we have no negotiation. The problem is that Putin can afford this because he's winning on the battlefield. Therefore, he said, well, I set the conditions. You know them. I'm winning on a battlefield. If you don't comply with my conditions, I continue to move ahead. And that means that the longer you wait, the smaller Ukraine will become. And that's exactly the situation where we are. The problem is that, again, the Europeans don't want any negotiation. Remember when we had the first attempt from the Trump administration to have this contact in Istanbul in February, March 2025, the Europeans made every effort to say Zelensky that he should not go into any negotiation with Russia, that any negotiation between the US and Russia would not be accepted by Europe, and therefore there would be no process. Basically, they were against any process, and we are back to what I said before, that the European Union made virtually no effort whatsoever to engage into some kind of political solution for the conflict. And that's the reason why the Trump administration don't even consider having the Europeans around the table, because they are not a party. They have never acted as a party to the conflict. I mean, they provided weapons to Ukraine, but in terms of negotiation and diplomacy, they are not a party to the negotiation.
Well, and really to your point there, I actually got on a text here just before we came on the air with Larry Johnson, a former CIA officer who's on our show every week, and he happens to be in Moscow right now on a prearranged trip already. And I asked him when all this stuff started breaking, what was going on in Russia, what they're saying. And he said he spoke to Maria Zakharova, the spokeswoman for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Russia yesterday, and asked about this plan. And she said, we haven't seen anything in writing. We're at least willing to look. We're going to consider it, but our core issues and core requirements remain the same. He spoke to General Aludinov this morning, which is the guy that was responsible for driving the Ukrainians out of Kursk area earlier this year. And he said, listen, it's a non-starter to ask us to give away Zaporizhia and the Kherson area. We're going to take it all, he said. And the Russians say that if giving up that part of that territory is part of the deal, it's a non-starter, but we are encouraged by at least some of our core issues are being addressed. But they said that unless that it's all of it, we'll simply keep driving militarily until we take it all. I mean,
well, yes,
but I can't do that.
The problem is that we don't know all the details of the plan, because it, as far as I understood, it's not about giving back Kherson and Zaporozhye. It's just setting the limit – to the battle line, I mean the front line. So that's it's not about giving back those two oblasts to Ukraine. It's just that instead of having the two oblasts according to their political borders, the idea is to take the front line as a border. It's in essence, as I said before, it's a compromise between what Putin asked and the Kiss-Kellogg plan. Kiss-Kellogg plan was to make the delineation on the front line. And so for the Donbass, okay, they have their political, the political borders are considered. But for the two southern oblasts, then that would be the front line. So again, I don't know exactly whether those people in Russia, when Johnson asked if they knew all the details of that. Me neither. I don't know. I'm not sure about the details. That's the information I have, meaning that, I mean, they're coming from Russian sources, so I assume they are correct. But again, there are still some doubt on it. In any case, the idea of having the two southern oblasts delineated by the front line and not the political border, this is something that apparently had been discussed in Anchorage between Vladimir Putin and Trump. And that's the compromise Putin was ready to consider and to engage into a negotiation. That's the level of information I have. Again, I'm not saying that I know everything, and maybe the information I have is wrong, but it would make some sense to find kind of a compromise between the two.
But let me ask you the question, though, from the Russian perspective. I mean, I can see an argument that why should they compromise on anything? If they say they want these lines, and they said, according to June 14, 2024 lines that Putin designated, it was all of the administrative borders to include Kherson and Zaporizhia. So why should they compromise on anything when they have the power to continue to compel it? Well, this Russian position, it's hard for me to argue against it.
No, absolutely. No, you're correct. Now, you have also to consider that in Russia itself, people start to be tired about the conflict. And that's a reality. If you look at the polls made by the Levada Center, you see that there is kind of a fatigue in the population about this. And that might be an aspect that is considered by Vladimir Putin. I don't know. And basically, you're right. Since they are winning, there is no real incentive for the Russians to make any concession to the Ukrainians. On the other hand, the idea that the fighting would continue without any prospect of ending soon might be also something that the Russian may say, okay, of course, we are winning, but on the other hand, we don't want to fight indefinitely. If we can find a compromise that helps the Ukrainian to make a decision to stop fighting, we are ready to go to do that. Again,
let me ask you one more thing here in the amount of time we have left here. One thing not included in the 28-point peace plan, at least what's been reported, and like you, we haven't seen the actual 28 points. We've only seen them characterized. But one thing that's not even mentioned in there is something that the Russians had listed back in June 2024 is a core requirement, and that is the denazification of the Ukraine side. Do you see Russia having a compromise to not include a denazification in any kind of a post-settlement?
Well, we have to understand what denazification means. Essentially, what Vladimir Putin meant at that time, I mean, in February 2022, was in fact the destruction of all those paramilitary forces that are considered as neo-Nazi by the Russians. And these were the paramilitary forces that were used by the Kiev government to repress the demonstrations and those people who demonstrated against I mean, when they demonstrated to keep their rights, I mean, especially the language issue. And therefore, since the army was not ready to fight or, yes, to repress those demonstrations, the Kiev government established those ultra-nationalist, I mean, you can find the expression you want. They established those units, paramilitary units, to fight against the so-called separatists. And they did that extremely brutally. There were people coming from the western part of Ukraine. I mean, these guys are extremely nationalist. They are part of the, if you look at the map of Ukraine, you would see that you have the Russian-speaking part, I would say, on the east and south. You have the Ukrainian-speaking part in the center, in the west. But the center of the south and east are Orthodox, of the Orthodox religion. If you go to the far west part, where you have those ultra-nationalists, people coming from the Austro-Hungarian Empire after World War One, those are Catholics. They don't have a lot of common. They feel Ukrainians, but they tend to despise the Slavs. Let's put it that way. And that's for that reason those paramilitaries were recruited in that region. And those did, I mean, they created the Azov Battalion, Pravi Sector, the OUN battalions and all that, which all originate from the Western part, even during World War II. These are movements that were created during World War II as independentist movement. They, from time to time, cooperated with the Germans, sometimes not, sometimes yes. So it is a very complex history. That's what I explained in my book, Covert Wars in Ukraine, by the way. But basically, they were fundamentally against the Slavs and the Soviets. And for that reason, these were the guys who made the Maidan Revolution, in essence. And that's also something that I explain in my book. And these are the guys who made all the brutalities, including torture and all that, between 2014 and 2022. So denazification refers to the destruction of those units. And formally, I could say, I mean, there's still this idea of denazification. But when you had the negotiation process in Istanbul in March 2022, at the end of March 2022, the Russian military high command said that the objective of denazification had been reached. Of course, that was probably in order to facilitate the dialogue in Istanbul at that time. It was probably not that it had been completely, the problem had been completely solved. But that was the time when the Azov Brigade was surrounded in Mariupol. You may remember this. And that was considered as a major success against, I mean, in the framework of this denazification. And for that reason, on the 28th of March 2022, the high command said, we reached the objective of denazification. That was reported by the Financial Times, if I'm not wrong, at that time. Now, of course, they came back with this accusation. This is something that comes back because obviously they are the Azov that used to be a brigade. Now you have two corps, army corps.
Expanded.
Exactly, it has expanded. Therefore, they can revive this objective. But this is the idea. I mean, denazification doesn't refer to what's happening in Kiev itself. It refers to the destruction of those fanatical units that that in fact make the bulk of the forces today. Because if you look at the where those corps are disseminated, in fact, they are part of these. They have the same function as the Waffen-SS had with the Germans in World War II. Kind of firefighters.
They even wear some of the same patches, if we can be honest.
Sorry?
They even have some of the same patches on their uniform.
Exactly, yes, in addition to that. But it's the same kind of use. That means that they use that as a kind of a reserve. That means if something burns, if things go bad in an area, they send those fanatics who are ready to fight up to the last drop. It's exactly the same example. I mean, you may remember in Cherkasy, which is in Ukraine, where the Germans send the French Brigade Charlemagne to open the cauldron of Cherkasy in 1943, if I'm not wrong, and these were SS. French SS. So, and today you have a very similar pattern in the use of those units as kind of firefighting, if you want. If something burns at one point, they send immediately those guys to solve the problem. So, meaning that the idea of denazification is probably still alive.
It is, yeah. And I'm sure for the Russians it is, and that'll be a sticking point. One of the reasons why I think probably we aren't going to get this peace plan involved, and Russia will probably continue on militarily until they take what they want on the battlefield. That's just what I see as the most likely outcome at this point. I hope I'm wrong. I hope that they do find some way, but that's what I fear is going to happen.
I agree with you. Totally.
Well, and on that cheery note, listen, though, before we let you go, I do want to bring up something to our folks here that you have a very interesting thing that you put out at a museum here that's a little bit pretty cool. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about it.
Well, that's an exhibition I have started. It will be a one-year exhibition in Switzerland in the Military Museum of Morges, that's between Geneva and Lausanne on the Lake of Geneva. It's a military museum. And here I have organized an exhibition that's basically my collection of items from clandestine warfare. And it's about the cooperation between Swiss intelligence and Allied intelligence during World War II. Only a few people know, the OSS, so the predecessor of the CIA, was based in Switzerland between 1942 and 1943, end of 1943, because then the Allied landed in Italy, and then they started to establish new headquarters in Italy. But between 1942 and 1943, most clandestine operations made by the OSS in Europe were led from Switzerland. And Alain Dulles, who later became the director of the CIA, was in fact the head of the OSS in Bern, in Switzerland. I know exactly the location. It happened that I used to live just close to the former headquarters of the USS. It was just a block away from my home when I lived in Bern. And I have a lot of weapons, artifacts, and all that to illustrate the work of the clandestine services, namely OSS, but also the British Special Operation Executive and the French BCRA, the Bureau Central de Renseignement et d'Action. And to illustrate all these activities and the work they have done with the Swiss intelligence, I have unique unique objects there, documents and pictures and all that to illustrate this phase of the war. And this is something I wanted to do because this is a part of history which is not very well known, even in Switzerland. Yeah. For instance, nobody knows that the Polish, we had the second Polish Rifle Division that was interned in Switzerland in 1940 as the Germans invaded France. And this division arrived at the border of Switzerland. It was interned, but instead of disarming this division, the commander-in-chief of the Swiss Army decided with the commander of the division to continue the training of this Polish division. And eventually those Polish soldiers came to the to reinforce the French resistance in France, and this division was allowed to maintain radio contact with London, where you had the provisional government of Poland that was based in London. So there are a lot of aspects of this clandestine warfare there. I have about 550 objects displayed there, including a few you have seen. One, this is where you have here an Enigma machine. This is a Swiss Enigma. This one doesn't belong to me. The NEMA, which is close to it, belongs to me, but the Enigma not. It was provided by my former employer, the Swiss Intelligence Service. They contributed to that. And there are also some items like a clandestine radio set that were used by the Soviet intelligence in the famous Red Orchestra that was based in Geneva. And the some items were confiscated. They're also displayed there. So it's a kind of a interesting, unique exhibition on clandestine warfare during World War II, with a focus on Switzerland and on the cooperation with the Allies. So yeah, something which is quite interesting for those who visit Switzerland. You can go by Mars to visit it.
Yeah, I'm going to try to get there, actually. I'm going to try to get there and see it. That'd be really cool to go see. So I'll have to let everybody know if I'm able to get there. But thanks very much for sharing that. And anybody else who's in Europe, and I know we have a number of folks, you should go and check it out.
Dan, if I could just interject for a second. A colonel, I see on your exhibit here, you have some swords up in the back there.
Right? Yes. So
what I'm curious, I'm just wondering, did you happen to maybe steal that from me? Do you see my?
You got your own little display there. What in the world?
I don't expect credit, but I just wanted to say, don't think that I miss out on that, Colonel.
Ah, damn! You found it.
Oh boy!
Very good. So glad to see you.
Yeah. Didn't know that Gary had those OSS connections. Who knew? But you never know. Well, listen, thanks very much for joining us today. This has been a fascinating episode, and capped off with an even more fascinating look at what people can go to Switzerland and see. So thank you so much for coming on today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me in the show, and thank you for the advertising for the exhibition. Thank you.
Always our pleasure. And thanks very much, folks. But we got more shows for you today. We're going to have Glenn Deason on the show here later on, and even something else that I'll leave that as a surprise. But we got plenty of things for you today, so be sure and check us out. See you next episode on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.